This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Coming up, three international voices with Connecticut connections. We'll talk with a Nigerian-American artist who paints with an iPad. We'll also learn the story of a Polish hero and find out what a top Polish official in America thinks of Ukraine's chances for success. Here's former U.S. Secretary of State Madeleine Albright talking about last month's presidential elections in Ukraine.
I think the elections went extremely well, very well in terms of the fact that it was organized, that people went out and voted, that they were patient to wait in lines, that the polling hours were extended, that there had really been a sense of that this was to build on what the demonstrators in the Maidan had done for months. Kind of restoring the dignity to the Ukrainian people. And their vote was really a very clear sign that they wanted independence, sovereignty, and democracy.
Matthew Schmidt is an assistant professor of national security and political science at the University of New Haven. He was in Ukraine as an elections monitor. We spoke with him just before his trip and wanted to find out what he saw. So he joins us once again today from the New Haven studios of WNPR. Matthew Schmidt, welcome back to Where We Live.
Hi, John. It's great to be here.
First of all, you weren't sure where you were going to be during this election. So where were you stationed?
Ultimately, I ended up in a city called Dnepropetrovsk, which is south of Kiev, about 5.5 hours. It is the city and the administrative region that borders Donetsk.
So it borders Donetsk. So what did you see there while you were watching these elections?
Well, the first thing I felt was sort of a widespread nervousness about the security situation. The thing you have to understand about Ukraine right now is it's sort of operating like a feudal system. There was an oligarch, a billionaire, that was appointed the governor of Dnepropetrovsk region and city. And the first thing he did was put out a bounty to entice people to go into Donetsk and Luhansk and fight the Russian separatists there. So Dnepropetrovsk was a city where a lot of these fighters are based from. And in fact, when you read in the news that Ukrainian forces of this number or that number have been attacked or engaged in an attack, a large number of those forces are in fact this kind of private militia from Dnepropetrovsk.
My goodness. So where you were, did you, aside from the nervousness that was clearly evident amongst the people, did you see any types of security problems? Did you ever feel unsafe where you were?
No, I never felt unsafe. As we were doing our interviews with precinct election commissions, what we found was that in each commission, there were one or two or three commissioners who were not reporting for work on election day because they were nervous about attacks into these stations on election day. Now, none of these attacks ever materialized. And eventually, I did talk to a precinct chair who was a member of this private Dnieper battalion, and he explained it to me like this. He said, we have, this battalion has roadblocks facing east out of Dnepropetrovsk, and they have roadblocks on the border with Donetsk. And so you'd have to get through two sets of roadblocks to get into the city. And in addition to that, he said there were about 600 of these members of the battalion roaming the city in rotating security positions.
One of the things that maybe you can help us understand is, as you say, this is a home to some of these militias. Is there any sort of pro-Russian sentiment that you could gather in the city where you were watching elections?
No, absolutely not. Everybody in the city was very geared towards ending the violence in the east and uniting Ukraine and moving on. They just wanted a normal life.
What was voter turnout like?
Voter turnout was high overall throughout the country. And it was high on the specific precincts that I witnessed.
As a witnesser of these elections, were you interviewing people sort of like an exit poll? Were you talking to voters?
No, we didn't do that. We merely observed. And then we marked down any kind of irregularities and things like that and then reported them back to the central headquarters of the OSCE in Kiev for them to do the statistical analysis.
I'm sure, though, you had some conversations while you were there. What was the sentiment? What were people saying to you as they considered this very important election?
Well, essentially, they wanted the security situation ended in the east, and so they were sort of holding their nose and voting for Pyotr Poroshenko, the top candidate who eventually won the campaign. And what they wanted to do was get him elected in the first round. so that there wouldn't be this break period of several weeks where more violence could break out and change the situation in the country.
What can you tell us about Petro Poroshenko?
He is known as the Chocolate King. He's a billionaire, and he has close ties to the Kremlin. And he was out on the Maidan early on in the protests and supported the Maidan movement to oust the previous president and to start to move Ukraine towards the West, towards the European Union. So he has a lot of credibility with the population in that sense. But on the other hand, everybody understands that he's a billionaire and that, you know, the two leading candidates in the election were billionaires, and they're still not to the point where sort of ordinary Ukrainians have a chance at any of these elections.
We're talking with Matthew Schmidt, an assistant professor of national security and political science at the University of New Haven. He witnessed the elections recently in Ukraine. He's reporting back to us about what he saw. Coming up later in our program, we'll hear an interview that I did with the Consul General of Poland from New York City, who happened to be visiting Connecticut. And we talked a little bit about the differences, some similarities between Ukraine and Poland, of course, as Poland celebrates 25 years of free elections. One of the things she said is really just that the Polish uprising, Solidarity, was led by dock workers. It was led by everyday Poles. And we see billionaires once again in control in Ukraine. How much of a problem is this for Ukraine moving forward, that the everyday person doesn't really necessarily have a say? And once again, we may see cronyism. We may see greed at the top.
It's a problem, but it's not a problem that anybody can do anything about soon. And so it's a necessary evil for quite a while. I see this continuing at least for another generation.
At least another generation. And is there any sense of anything that could happen on the ground or any leadership that could change that?
I'm not sure. The biggest problem that Ukraine faces right now, that Poroshenko faces, is to manage the expectations of the country when two things happen. When they find out that they're not going to become part of NATO, and when they find out that they're not likely to become part of the European Union. The thing that nobody is talking about is Putin has been extremely successful in blocking Ukraine from becoming part of the European Union. Because in order to become part of the EU, you have to settle all of your border disputes. Well, Crimea. As long as that's not settled, and as long as the Ukrainian government isn't willing to give away Crimea officially, I don't see any route for them becoming part of the European Union.
What role, if any, do you think that President Obama's visit to Poland, his talk with Poroshenko, his support of NATO, and his strong talk about support for Ukraine, does this have any impact at all on the ground there?
It's usually important symbolically. It's usually important that military exercises will now likely be moved from Italy and Germany into Poland and into the Baltic states. It doesn't mean a lot in terms of there's no American military aid or things like that going into Ukraine. So Poroshenko understands that, and he's basically on his own. But it's important that he has a sense that the United States is backing him.
We just have a few minutes left, but I'm wondering if you could predict from what you saw and how you view the situation, what the coming months in Ukraine may be. More of these local security situations, more of the town-by-town skirmishes that you see and that you reported on. How do you think the next few months play out?
I think in the immediate future, you're going to see a lot more violence in the east. Poroshenko, the day after he was elected, launched the largest assault of the war so far. The Ukrainian military is not very good, and they're fighting against decent military operatives with the separatists. And so I think you're going to see a lot of back and forth. The turning point will come when you start hearing about large numbers of these Russian separatists crossing the border back into Russia. And we haven't seen that yet. And I think that there's several more weeks, if not months, of this kind of violence going on. And then the next big point will be the parliamentary and elections and the constitutional referendum, which was supposed to be this last May, but has now been pushed off into the fall. And the structure of that referendum will decide the future of eastern Ukraine.
We just have a few seconds left, but was this vote inspiring at all? You said that the populace had to hold its nose and vote for Poroshenko. Did you feel inspiration at the polls?
I did. The youth movement is extremely strong. It's extremely deep. It's more than just the elections. It's sort of a movement away from their parents' generation in terms of the kind of food that they eat and their value structure. And then I was amazed at the women. Ukrainian women ran these election commissions. They organized them. They held everything together.
Matthew Schmidt is a professor of national security and political science at the University of New Haven. He was our eyes and ears on the ground in Ukraine. Thank you so much for your conversation today. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Coming up next, we'll get the take on the Ukrainian situation from a top Polish official in the U.S. who is visiting Connecticut this week. That's coming up next here on Where We Live. This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankowski. Earlier this week, President Obama was in Poland to meet with Ukrainian President-elect Petro Poroshenko. This is part of a European tour in which he's asking lawmakers to back a plan to support and train NATO forces on Russia's border.
I'm calling on Congress to approve up to $1 billion to support this effort, which will be a powerful demonstration of America's unshakable commitment to our NATO allies.
The president also spoke at a ceremony marking the 25th anniversary of free elections in Poland, a country that was also under communist rule for decades. Ewa Juńczyk-Ziemiecka was a journalist when Poland became a free country. She's now consul general from the Consulate of the Republic of Poland in New York City. She visited New Britain on Tuesday to speak at CCSU about a World War II veteran who's being honored at the university in an exhibit called The World New, Jan Karski's Mission for Humanity. It's sponsored by the Polish Studies Program at CCSU, which is celebrating now its 40th anniversary. I asked her to tell us who Jan Karski was.
Jan Karski was called and is called now as a one man who tried to stop the Holocaust. To me, he belongs to the history as one of the most courageous men who was the Polish underground officer and diplomat who was sent by the Polish government on exile in London from Poland through the whole occupied Europe to Great Britain and then to the United States with the terrible messages. He had a report about not only the condition of the occupied Poland, but also about the Holocaust. He decided to be an eyewitness. He went, risking his own life, to see the condition, to see terrible things.
A few years ago, President Barack Obama awarded a Presidential Medal of Freedom to Jan Karski. And in doing so, he made some misstatements, or they were widely read as misstatements, calling the Nazi death camps Polish death camps.
Before one trip across enemy lines, resistance fighters told him that Jews were being murdered on a massive scale and smuggled him into the Warsaw ghetto and a Polish death camp to see for himself.
How did the people of Poland react to this?
It's very easy to imagine how do we react. I was there, and we were all in shock. But I must tell you, frankly, that being a consul general in New York, part of my job is to constantly write letters. Each time when such a description, which is false historically, appears in the media. And a few years ago, when I just started my post in New York, along with Kościuszko Foundation in New York, we decided that we would try to include into the media style books a proper naming for the concentration camps, which was the Nazi German concentration camps on the occupied territories. Unfortunately, most of the Nazi German concentration camps were located in Poland for the simple fact that Poland was the heart of the Jewish diaspora. So each time the journalist, of a lack of education, would try to say the Polish concentration or death camp, the style books would automatically edit properly.
What do you think that the impact of all of this history, these misunderstandings, has had on Jewish-Polish relations?
First of all, Poland lost almost the whole Jewish community as a result of the Second World War. And those who survived after the war, many of them left Poland for different reasons. That was the communist country. that it wasn't the choice of Poles. That was, you know, the Russian that took over Poland after the war. So in a sense, we lost the war. And the communist country had some rules that we have to follow, such as censorship, manipulation of the history. And for years we can't do much about it. And so the Polish-Jewish relation was absolutely non-existent. For example, I was born after the war and in Warsaw. And I lived on the street where during the war that was the Warsaw Ghetto. And I don't know much about Jews. This is such a vital and important part of the Polish history. My parents mentioned something, but we never learned about it until the communists collapsed. When the communists collapsed, all of the either manipulated or deleted chapters of the history, suddenly the society, including myself, we rediscover our own history again. And so suddenly the whole society went through the educational process. Mm-hmm. And it's not that long process, it's only 25 years. And I'm happy to be here today because today we start to celebrate this freedom that we accomplished, society accomplished. What happened that the collapse of the communists started in Poland with Lech Wałęsa and Solidarność. And finally, the communists collapsed by the fact that Poles went to... We organized election. The first free election took place 25 years ago. And so that was the end of the communists at the beginning of this educational process of tightening all the relation, and one of the most important with Jews, with Polish Jews.
It is so interesting that what you describe, that because of communist rule over all those years, you didn't have access to the real history of mm-hmm. what happened during World War II. It's fascinating that this is almost like an enlightenment of 25 years ago, and now Poles can read about their history, including the very terrible piece of the history.
I have a wonderful news that I would like to share.
Yes.
Which is related to the Polish-Jewish relations. On October 28th this year, the Museum of the History of Polish Jews will be open in Warsaw, educational and a cultural center that covers 1,000 years of presence of Jews on the Polish soil. Because the stereotypes is, which is the consequences of this terrible Second World War that happened on the European soil, that Jews were present for so long that we used to believe, now when we learn, there is no full history of Poland without the history of Polish Jews. Mm. So anyone who believed that history of Jews is only the most tragic Holocaust chapter will learn that maybe your ancestors, maybe you who listen now on the radio, and you are from Poland, maybe your grandfather was from Poland, you can learn more, and maybe you find in this museum some facts that your ancestors accomplished so much mm-hmm. in different fields on the Polish soil, mm-hmm. being a part of the biggest diaspora in Europe for centuries.
We're talking with Ewa Junczyk-Ziemecka. She's Consul General from the Consulate of the Republic of Poland. She was in New Britain this week to speak at CCSU about the exhibit The World New, Jan Karski's Mission for Humanity. It's sponsored by the Polish Studies Program there. This is where we live. We spoke on Tuesday when President Obama was in Warsaw, pledging support to NATO as Russia continues to exert influence on neighboring Ukraine. I asked her to talk about what Ukrainians might learn from the Polish experience.
When the communists collapsed in Poland, the Russian army were there. Imagine, the Russian troops were on the Polish soil, as they were for since the war ended. So on one side, we have a new government, And on the other side, we were surrounded by Russians. So the first thing that Lech Wałęsa, who became a president, our legendary leader of solidarity, he said, Russian must go home. And for us, the symbol of being free was to be a member of NATO. And here is the President Obama in Poland, a day before anniversary of our freedom. And as you know, Poles are very pro-Americans because democracy that is here in the United States, it is something that you know, we are trying to have in our country. And we believe that we have it. Kościuszko, by the way, and Pulaski, they were your heroes and our heroes. And they were for the same, you know, fought in Poland and in the United States for freedom and for democracy, right? So, you know, I'm very glad that President Obama is there because it's also a signal that that this is what we want to have on our east side border, democratic society.
Are you concerned about what is happening in Ukraine now, and how do you think that it will affect Poland?
Of course that we are concerned, especially the old generation. The old generation still remember a war.
And they still remember, as you say, being surrounded by Russians.
Absolutely. And as we remember, the Second World War started on the 1st of September 1939 by German attacks Poland on the east side, on the west side, and Russians 17 days later, on 17th of September, attacked Poland on the east side. And at that time, Russians and Germans were allies, right? So those who remember, of course they are afraid. And plus, you know, for example, what one of my mother's friends said, when the Hitler took power, that was the Olympics in Munich, remember? Mm-hmm. And then everything in Germany headed into the Second World War. We just had an Olympics in Sochi.
Yes, we did.
You see? So for all generation, the similarity is very... This is not unrealistic, I believe. There's only their fear. But we supported Ukraine with their urge to democratic society, and we will be supporting Ukraine for the, you know, attempt to build a democratic open society.
One thing that I have heard in the struggle over Ukraine and the reason why both Russia and the European Union are so drawn to making sure Ukraine is part of their sphere is they see a great deal of potential in Ukraine, the same type of potential that has been shown in Poland. Mm-hmm. Since your freedom 25 years ago, you've built a very robust economy. You have a very high literacy rate. You have a country that seems ascendant, and I'm wondering what you think the recipe might be for Ukrainians themselves to take some control of the situation, to be able to do what you were part of when Solidarity happened in Poland, and to actually make your own future.
Unfortunately, unfortunately, Ukrainians, they didn't concentrate on the economics reforms. Many of the members of the establishment, as we know, they were concentrating on their egoistic own wealth. So instead of developing the huge and sometimes very difficult reforms, as we did, they were stealing. I hardly imagine my Polish president or any of the minister who would concentrate on collecting goods instead of, you know, trying to write new regulations and lead the society to the difficult but unnecessary reforms. What happened in Poland is that we had a very courageous economist. His name was Balcerowicz, Professor Leszek Balcerowicz. He just received a very prestigious an American award, Milton Friedman Award, and the Waldorf Astoria in New York for his accomplishment, for his courage to make a free economy. And we call it the Balcerovich regulation. The society was mad on him because everybody were suddenly very poor. And we didn't expect that. We regain independence to be happy, not to take everything on our own shoulder. And suddenly freedom means also economic freedom. You are responsible for your own life. There is no society anymore who are responsible for you. No. We have now to think about how to organize our life. And in the same time, we soon realized that the free economy are making us with such a provoke us to have our own ideas. How to organize a business? How to organize the neighborhood? How to organize the government? How to organize the city? Suddenly, so many initiatives, individual initiatives, just, it was like a bombing. But we went through. And of course, there was a lot of sacrifices on the society side, a lot of sacrifices. Unfortunately, such a thing never happened in Ukraine. So the only chance for them, and for us, of course, because when Ukraine will be democratic, the European Union will be stronger. And we wish that Ukraine would start with the economic reforms, and Poland is behind them.
I want to ask you one last thing, because you're here and you're visiting Central Connecticut State University in New Britain, and New Britain is the home of a very large Polish community that we're spending quite a bit of time here on WNPR looking into, and we're going to be doing a series of reports. That economic reform that you talked about, where the Polish people had to, from scratch essentially, work to make something of themselves, it seems as though probably they were informed in that by the great Polish diaspora that came to America, the people who built places like New Britain, Connecticut. Mm-hmm. They probably learned quite a bit about how to make a country in Poland by their brothers and sisters and fathers and mothers who came here and did some of the same things and opened up shops and built churches and did all these things right here.
Not only this, the Polish Americans, for years after the war, they were a voice of Poland. We couldn't talk. We had a censorship. We couldn't debate. There was no possible for us to make political moves. Who talked on our behalf? The Polish Americans. The Polish Americans in New Britain and in Hartford, in New York, in Chicago, the Polish American Congress, and veterans organizations such as you, the one that you have here at Hartford, and give me this opportunity to thank them. Because they were our voice. That was a voice of Poland. They were talking with an American administration, with their senators, with their congresswomen and congressmen. They wanted Poland to be free. And years of their insist work resulted with freedom of Poland.
Mm.
Thank you.
Madam Consul, thank you so much for speaking with us. I appreciate it.
Thank you very much.
Ewa Junczyk-Jumecka is Consul General from the Consulate of the Republic of Poland. To listen back to an interview that I did a few years back with the famed Polish economist Leszek Balcerowicz, and to learn more about WNPR's year-long Polish Stories project, go to polishstories.wnpr.org. Coming up, we'll talk with Nigerian-American artist and curator Olu Ogwibe. That's coming up, Where We Live. This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankowski. Coming up on tomorrow's show, the responsibilities of local government include operating public schools, cleaning the streets, protecting citizens. On the next Where We Live, we'll talk with a panel of local firefighters who do just that, both full-time and volunteers. As buildings get safer, there are fewer massive fires. Those fighting the flames are picking up some new responsibilities. Some are traveling around the country to fight forest fires elsewhere. You can join a conversation with firefighters coming up on the next Where We Live. Olu Ogwibe is a Nigerian-American artist whose exhibition iPad Prints is on exhibit at Real Artways in Hartford right now. It's a series of large-scale prints created with a 21st-century tool by an artist whose work has ranged from traditional painting to poetry, cultural criticism, and curation. He sat down with us to talk about his work and to share some of his thoughts on the current climate in his home country of Nigeria. Olu Ogwibe, thank you so much for being here. I appreciate it.
It's my pleasure, John.
I saw this exhibit called iPad Prints at Real Artways, and I'd like to talk about this. Can you tell us about making art on the iPad? When did you start doing this?
I began, in fact, the very day that the iPad was made public. I got it, and I was so excited about it. And I started doodling with it straight away. The conversation around at the time was that it's a consumer product. Mm-hmm. I didn't think that made sense because I was producing content right away, you know. And the very first things that I did, I simply referred to as iPad doodles. I got more serious. It went from play to serious work because I could see the potential.
When you take a look at a tool like this that is a new tool, you said you got it as soon as it came out. How do you begin going about the process of figuring out how to create art with it? Is it as simple as doodling first and then becoming more formal in what you're doing, or is there a different way in which you have to approach a technology like this in order to make art with it?
The iPhone was already there, so one had a sense of the potential, and I got familiar with the interface itself because it's not very different, quite frankly. It's just larger.
Well, and how much is it like painting?
It's not very different, actually, because, you know, it's quite fascinating that pigments become digital, but you have a palette. And it's the same process. You pick your pigment. You pick whether you want a brush or you want a pencil. You pick the tool that you need. And in a sense, it kind of recalled growing up in a rural area where you start on the sand outside. You know, you don't exactly start with books and so on. You go out on the grounds and you play and you draw, which is where I started drawing, was all, you know, in the sand. And it's pretty much like that.
One of the things that's interesting to me about it, though, is whether it's on an iPhone, which is very small, and an iPad, which is slightly larger, you're creating something which then, as you go into the exhibition space, you see these very, very large prints and watch them come to life. Can you talk about that transference process? Because when you're painting on canvas, the size of the canvas is the size of the painting, right?
Yeah, it's predetermined.
It's predetermined. This is something very different in which you're creating something that once it's enlarged and hanging on the wall, it takes on entirely different, to me, I'm sure, meanings, but as far as scale, as far as the way in which the colors kind of blend or the way in which the viewer is immersed into the painting, it's quite a bit different than if you're seeing it on a little screen.
Absolutely. And I think that's why I was very much interested in defying the limitations of the tool itself, because the iPad gives you a very low-resolution image. So I was keen to see if I could defy that, if there's a way that I could take those tiny little image files and manifest them in other forms. What's interesting to me is the portability of the tool itself, the fact that you can make these images just about anywhere. Most of these I made, in fact, lying in bed, because, you know, as I pointed out in some of the literature that went with the exhibition, during the period I created these particular images, I was going through a depression, you know, and I didn't leave the house much. And so this made it possible for me to continue making work. And one of the things about depression is that it's necessary for you to keep doing something. And that's why writers have a harder time with depression, because many of them are unable to write. With an artist, I think it's a little easier if you have your tools there to keep making something, creating something. And that sort of ties you through certain periods. And the easy facility of this tool made it available for me to use it in that form while, you know, also experimenting, trying to discover what other things I could do with it.
You're a visual artist, but you're also you're a critic and you're a writer, and you are a multidisciplinary person. I'm wondering if you can explain how you go about this thing of being an artist. Like, what an artist is to you, because you do so many things and you've done so many things. One might interface with your work now by going and seeing it hanging on the walls and knowing that it's iPad prints that are done from a time of some personal struggle. But there's so much more to your story. Can you talk a bit about what it means to you to be an artist today?
I look at it two ways. There's the creative individual, and then there's the professional. And I think that the professional is the person who makes their living from making art. I know that disqualifies a whole lot of people from that category.
A lot of artists don't make a living making art.
That
yes.
is true. And quite frankly, that's the way I look at it. It is a profession. It's a trade. But it's also a creative endeavor. It's a talent. It's a gift. And in that sense, there are far many more artists than there are professional artists. I think just about everyone out there has some artistic or creative talent that could manifest visually. Not everyone, you know, does, but most people do. And I've always been fascinated. For many years, I've been fascinated by the fact that throughout history, you find instance after instance of individuals who were not visual artists, but who found expression in whatever they do, initially through drawing or doodling or making sketches. And we're talking Pushkin here, for instance, Alexander Pushkin. We're talking Miles Davis was always drawing, and so many others who were either musicians or playwrights, worked in different other areas of creativity, but always sort of found some outlet, almost compulsive or impulsive outlet in visual art. The ones who make a living from it are, quite frankly, the ones that I regard as professional artists. And that's a whole different ballgame from just making art. There are too many of us that make art, but there are only few who are real professionals who wake up almost every day and go into the studio and try to make some work and try to sell some work, try to support themselves. It's quite a challenging experience.
But and one of the things I think that makes it a challenging experience is something that you also have done, which is criticism. Criticism of art, literature, theater is... It's important for art to have critics, but it also can be in some ways destructive if the criticism is bad. It can hit somebody at exactly the wrong time as a viewer, and you can have your own thoughts about something be completely and utterly turned around by having read what somebody said about it. Can you talk about transferring this idea of being a critic to then being an artist? Because sometimes these two sides are on opposite sides of the fence.
That's true. I look at criticism in two or three ways, though. There's criticism as appreciation, which is my favorite way of approaching criticism. There's criticism as advocacy, which is something I do quite a lot, too. And then, of course, there's just criticism as reading, which is very useful, as you pointed out, because it's, you know, four good pairs of eyes are sometimes better than just two. That extra voice from outside that points out things that the artist might not have seen or noticed comes in very handy. And you find that with emerging artists, that can be a problem, the fact that they have no access to that other voice, to some form of editing. You know, writers are luckier in the sense that before they come into the public, they go through that process of editing. Someone else comes in and says, how about this and how about that? Could you change that? Have you considered this? In many instances, especially emerging artists, do not have that advantage. So they go right from conception, creation, to the public without any critical intervention or editing, you know, yeah. Advantage. And that can be a problem. So I think criticism plays a very important role in that sense. But it's also created careers, it's destroyed careers, mm-hmm. You're quite right about it. And I think that in my case, being an artist informs my attitude to criticism. It makes me a little more, I think, sensitive to the power of criticism, as well as the necessity of criticism. And being a critic, obviously, you know, it gives me an insight also into how critics think. And, you know, I also curate, which I bring into play as well. When I'm curating, I try to take the position of the artist, because there's a lot of curators out there who may have gone to art school but never practiced as professionals, which is something I have done. You know, I don't just make art. I've had periods when I did actually forgo everything else, you know, teaching and all of that, and just devote myself to making art and trying to make a living from art. And that experience can inform how you approach curating.
You published a book called The Culture Game.
That's right.
And
quite a while ago.
One of the things that's interesting is this idea of hidden biases within the contemporary art world. I'm wondering if you can tell us what you mean by that, and maybe what you might think about that differently than when you published this.
At the time that I wrote many of the pieces in the book, and it was written over quite a period of time, perhaps a whole decade. But at the time, the pervading discourse was around interrogating the attitude of the Western art establishment to artists from a non-Western background, especially those who practice in the West. In fact, in many instances, it just be that the color of their skin means they have an ancestry elsewhere, not even that they come from elsewhere. It could be African-American artists. It could be, you know, I read something on Facebook yesterday. Someone was pointing out that on the list of American masters, the PBS program, American Masters, there isn't a single African-American visual artist, not one. Mm. But of course, you know, that doesn't mean there won't be any in the future, but this is just an observation. Now, I was trying to say
that would be for a different show, right? Yeah. Of course, they'd say great African-American artists.
Exactly.
Right?
It'd be great African-American masters rather than American masters. Who knows? And I think that was the whole thing, that some of us who'd emerged from different parts of the world and kind of converged, almost accidentally converged in the West in the 1990s, late 80s, began to look into how the art establishment in the West looked at artists from somewhat different backgrounds and how much access those artists had to institutions, to opportunities. And, you know, we started out with some discussion around background, for instance. And you'd be surprised how far some people would push that, you know, in discussing an artist who's probably lived in New York for 20, 25 years, they'll constantly want to go back to his village somewhere in Africa. You know, he probably hasn't been there like I haven't been, you know, in 15, 20 years. You know, they want to know, did you practice animism? You know, did you grow up as a Christian? It has nothing to do with the work. And in terms of acquisition of work, even though the artist lives in New York, they would be ignored because someone has bought a work from Africa. We've got the Africans in the collection. So this guy's busy, you know, working away with contemporaries in New York, but nobody looks at what he's doing because they've gone to Africa and got something.
Before we started talking on tape, as we were sitting down, I said I would want to ask you about Nigeria, where you come from. And as you've said, you've not been there for quite some time. You haven't lived there in quite a bit longer ago. Does where you grew up now in your life, does it influence the art that you make in any tangible, substantive way? Or like many of us, I grew up in Western Pennsylvania and I live here now and I live in Connecticut. Does it really not make all that much a difference to who you are on a daily basis?
It's always there.
Yeah.
But I think it does get crowded out by other experiences as well, because, you know, you're accumulating experiences and they're not subsumed under some originary overriding, overarching experience, I don't think. Back in the 90s, in fact, I started writing about it, and I did write an essay about that whole thing of where you were born and how you're supposed to be tied to where you were born all your life. And I didn't think that made a whole lot of sense, you know, because we do move on, retaining what we can, retaining what we cannot do without, and some more than others. I have friends who go back all the time. They go back every year. They can't go through a whole year or two without returning.
And why don't you go back more often?
I don't feel the need. And in my case, I think I've been fortunate to accumulate vast variety of experience. Living in Britain for 6 years and coming here, I've been here for, I don't know, almost 20 years now, and growing up back in Africa, I think that's a wonderful opportunity to experience the world in a slightly different way than someone who's in their little town all of their lives.
And because of all that, all of that you've said, what does it mean to you to see the place where you grew up, a place that you don't know as well anymore, that you don't stay in touch with in the same way you did, to be in such turmoil, to see it in the news headlines as this just broken society, and not for the first time over the course of your lifetime, but once again seemingly a place where there's lawlessness and there's corruption, and it seems like there's so much wrong. How does it strike you as someone who comes from there and reads it in the newspaper?
I look back and I try to remind myself that it's always been that way, really. You know, when I was young, I did not accept that it's always been that way. But in recent years, I've gone back and I've read, you know, for instance, I've been, again and again, I've been reading our famous author, Chinua Achebe's novel, No Longer a Tease, which was published in 1960. And it describes exactly what's happening now in 1960. I mean, you know, 50-something years ago, it was already like it is now. And of course, I grew up in a bitter civil war as a war child. So when you've gone through all of that, I think what strikes you is, how come it never gets better? Why can't it get better? And what I've personally arrived at is a different conclusion than others have in the past. Chinua Achebe, for instance, wrote a Jeremiad in the 80s called The Trouble with Nigeria. And his conclusion was that there's nothing wrong with Nigerians, that it was simply a failure of leadership. I've come to disagree with that, because I don't think that a society can fail generation after generation simply because of a failure of leadership. There must be a certain element of a failure of citizenship, of people not taking individual responsibility for the fate and fortune of their society. It can't just be the leadership. You know, the leadership does come from the citizenship as well. It doesn't drop from the sky. So I've arrived at the conclusion that what ails the place is that people have not yet arrived at the point of taking responsibility for their own individual actions. And do they even have their own individual visions of where they want the society to be in another generation, what they want for their children? And when you think about it, they may say things, but do they do enough to match what they say about what they desire?
I can imagine it would be hard to have that vision if it hasn't changed since 1960 or well before then.
It hasn't moved one bit, you know? And some people like to blame the white man and colonialism and so on. And there's an element of truth in all that. But also, after so many years, after several generations, any society, any culture should be able to take some responsibility for where it's at and where it's going.
Thank you so much for talking about this and everything else that we talked about today. I truly appreciate it.
Thank you, John. It's my pleasure being here.
That's Olu Ugwibe. His latest exhibit is called iPad Prints. It's available for viewing now through July 6th at Real Artways in Hartford. We have more information on our website, WNPR.org. Our program is produced by Lydia Brown and Tucker Ives. The executive producer is Katie Talarski. I'm John Dankosky. Thanks for joining us.